Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest.
Welcome to Beyond Brunel. Today we're talking about all things roads and asking the question, does the Southwest need a rethink on roads? In the studio, join me is Richard Stevens, Managing Director of Go Southwest, which includes Plymouth City Bus Limited, and online with Jason Hum, Director of Transport and Highways at Gloucestershire County Council. Welcome to both of my guests. It's a pleasure to have you here. We'll start off by asking that question, and I'll go to you first, Richard. Does the Southwest need a rethink on roads?
I think the Southwest needs to keep thinking about roads in terms of how we rethink that. I think we have to be really aware of the world we're living in today and make sure that our roads are fit for purpose, not just for now, but, you know, intergenerational. I think you only have to look at what happens in schools recently with concrete. You can't stop investing in infrastructure. You can't take your eye off that ball. So I think the Southwest has to keep thinking about roads.
Brilliant. And I'm going to throw it to you, Jason, straight away. Does the Southwest need a rethink on roads? What's your take on that?
I think we need a bit of a rethink on the wider transport network, of which obviously roads are part of that. Whether it's the roads per se, or more specifically, probably how we use them, what our division of use across different transport forms is, how we can make sure that, I guess, our roads within that transport network are fit for purpose for what we need, certainly in the short term. That's how people use them at the moment, but particularly the sort of medium and longer term, certainly in terms of how we move from the levels of car use that we've got at the moment and begin to decarbonise, but also we cope with the needs of the economy and growth as well.
That's a useful insight, and we'll come back to this question at the end of our conversation. But for now, what I'm wondering, Richard, is we've got an awful lot of roads in the Southwest, as you'll be aware. And so I'm interested in what are the gripes of your drivers? You know, what are the problems that they're coming back to you and talking about? Is it congestion? Is it the condition of the roads, potholes?
It's all of the above. So, I mean, in terms of driving a bus, which I do quite regularly, road surface is key. You know, you want to make sure that you've got a good road surface that goes to comfort and safety. Safety, better signage. The point was made well earlier. How we share the space and how we share the road network is really, really important to our bus drivers. But also it's about behaviours. It's other users' behaviours. And you know, an awful lot of the challenges that bus drivers face are actually inconsiderate use of roads by other people. And I'm not saying buses are never in the way, but we could all make use of the roads better if we drove with a bit more consideration.
Jason, do you think behaviours is a theme which spans different transport types? Is it limited alone to buses and our road network, or is it kind of span different transport mechanisms?
Yeah, behaviours are really important in terms of how we're making the most efficient and effective use of the road. So whether that is around making sure that we get effective use of the capacity of the roads is a key element in terms of the behaviour and how they're used, and therefore whether the movement of whatever vehicles, whether that's cars or buses, but the movement of those vehicles is efficient and effective. But also the safety angle as well is really key. And that is reflective of not only things like the quality and the condition of road surface, but also reflective of those behaviours as well. So how the network is used, it has a key impact on the efficiency and effectiveness, but also the safety of the roads as well. And again, our use at present and what our use will maybe naturally become, or how we can encourage communities to begin to use the network and the roads in a different way as well.
And Richard, in terms of those behaviours and in terms of safety, is it purely on drivers, or is it partly on engineers and infrastructure professionals who are kind of developing that infrastructure? Where does that lie?
I think it's on all of us. I mean, I've been a Heart of the Southwest LET board member now for 7 years, so I see the amount of effort that engineers put into designing road schemes and infrastructure projects, and they try to take account of all the safety aspects that you can think of. But the reality is human beings are in chaos most of the time, and you can't predict the unpredictable. So, you know, I think the responsibility is on all of us. I think in terms of how we design schemes, there's always a compromise. And I think what I've witnessed is that safety is the last thing to be compromised. You know, that's a sacrosanct objective in any road scheme. And I've watched people impressively be very innovative in trying to improve safety. I think also, you know, if we just look at our post-COVID world, our experiences, we're seeing approximately 10% more traffic volumes on the road. You know, we've seen a degradation of bus speeds in that similar vein, around 10% road speeds, and that's making it very difficult to run reliable bus services. But the thing that I always think is interesting, and it's about this sort of demand management, is we don't generally have congestion in school holidays on the road network. But as soon as we're in school term time, then we have congestion. And I think this road management piece is definitely an area for the future where, you know, I don't want to bandy around too loosely, but where AI may help, is that we'll be able to take the data available and use the road space in a smarter way.
Jason, just touching on that point about capacity and changes in use of roads, either whether it's seasonal or post-COVID, you must have seen differences after COVID in road use, or, you know, has it affected long-term trends?
Yeah, it has. And I think, as in life, most of us are still either transitioning to what the new norm is, if you like, on a day-to-day basis in our general lives, let alone what our travel patterns are as well. I think in general, that propensity to work from home has increased a little bit for most industries, not all, but for most. So ideally, that brings down a little bit of the overall total usage, if you like. And what we've seen as well is a flattening of peaks. So the traditional sort of morning peak and evening peak are still there, but they're less spiky, if you like, than previously. So a slight reduction overall on average traffic movements, if you like, across a working week. And usually those peaks flatten down a little bit, which really takes account of maybe people being a bit more flexible in their work patterns, maybe starting a little bit later or flexibly finishing at different times as well. So that's helped. Of course, there's two aspects to it. One is around, as I say, the effective use of the network within its busy times and how close that is to capacity. As Richard said, there is still lots and lots of busy times. And then, as I say, how our traffic patterns will change or grow. And as I've mentioned earlier, how we will accommodate some of the growth that we need to accommodate as a region as well.
And I'm interested in that piece about the future. And so, Richard, I wonder, you know, what does the future of your fleet look like? Is it using purely gas? Is it hydrogen? Is it electric? Is it using AI to inform your systems?
I mean, the most immediate transition that's achievable for us is probably all electric vehicles or all electric buses. The technology is there. It's maturing. It's very expensive. It's double the price of a standard diesel double-decker bus. So that gives us a capital expenditure challenge. But the scale of what the UK bus industry needs to do to get to net zero shouldn't be underestimated. It is a significant transition. And the other challenge is that although the technology is improving and is credible, it's not a solution for every bus service, particularly in a deeply rural area. So as a group, we've invested in hydrogen fuel cell buses. In fact, I was up in Brighton just a few weeks ago driving one of the first ones that are in the UK just to see how it behaves in relation to a diesel bus. So I think it'll be a mixture of propulsion means. And the final solution may not even have been developed yet. So I think everybody thought it'd be revolution to net zero, and I really don't think it will. I think it's going to be an evolutionary process over time. So I think buses of the future, over the next 10 years, I think you're still going to see diesel buses on the road. I think some deeply rural settings will still be running diesel buses in 10 years' time. I'd like to think I was wrong, but intuitively, I think that's where we'll end up. But, you know, the future immediately looks electric.
And Jason, in terms of our net zero aspirations, how achievable do you think they are?
I think they're incredibly difficult. I think it takes some really difficult and tough decisions across all of our communities and some of our community to lead. I think the principles are hugely well supported. I think that has been well tested, particularly from my side, working in public sector and seeing a little bit more of that sharp end of the politics as well. I think, therefore, those principles, most authorities and partners have signed up to climate emergencies and obviously decarbonising of transport. Depending on where you are, is anywhere between sort of 30 and 40% of the transport emissions for a particular area. I think the challenge comes with all of us, and I won't take myself out of this equation. I think the challenge comes when you begin to implement a series of changes to support those overall principles, and therefore what that means in terms of impact on the individual, either in terms of the ease or freedom of their journey, the time that their journey would take, or the cost of their journey as well. And I think as those leaders within the sector, we've also got to look at it in both, I suppose, both carrot and stick. What provision do we have to help support and encourage people into more sustainable choices for their transport? And what other levers do we have to help convince people that now is the right time? And why it is so difficult is that those communities are used to the way that we travel, but also there's a whole host of other challenges in terms of cost of transport, demands on individuals, times. The overall approach, as I say, is well supported, but the challenge is how you implement the individual decisions to help collectively move a community or a region towards those steps that we know we need to take.
What we've got to do is find a way of making sure that the alternative to what people currently experience is credible and convenient. And you know, we've got a new national bus strategy, but we need the investment to bring it to life. We've made a lot of progress in cycleways, but we need to do more. And I think in terms of how we manage cars, particularly in our urban settings, I think we've got to sort of rethink about whether or not it's really credible to have a car parked outside every house. Don't take an anti-car approach. It's too simplistic to say we'll get rid of all the cars, but we can displace them. We can build out of town, multi-story car parks that effectively could be community charging stations. They could be community batteries that support the national grid. So you can have a car to go about your life, but you don't take your car into a deeply urban setting. And if you want to see an example, Venice is a pretty good example of that. Venetians still own cars. They just can't drive them in Venice for obvious reasons.
And Richard, encouraging people to make more sustainable choices and use public transport, is that something that you're already planning for?
I've spent 30 years trying to achieve modal shift. It feels like the Holy Grail, to be quite honest. And the number of people using public transport is pretty stubborn. I mean, even now, the government has created a cost of living exercise to support bus passengers with a £2 maximum single fare offer. And even that hasn't really driven significant growth in numbers, because we are habitually, as a nation, you know, we are car users. So the bus industry has worked very hard over the years to try and encourage people to not give up their car, but to use sustainable transport means for some of their journeys. And I think all of us probably could make a 20% reduction in our car journeys without any detriment to our lives. We just don't choose to do that. Things like the apps that we have now, the travel companions, where you can actually see the bus coming along on your screen. You don't have to worry about the timetable. You can stay in your home and just walk out because you and the bus can find itself at the right time in the right place. That's moved it on. I think some of the ticketing scheme initiatives in Cornwall, we've got a multimodal ticketing scheme. Any bus, any ticket, you just get on the first bus that arrives that's going in the direction you want to go. The most recent passenger satisfaction survey put that facility to use any bus with your ticket above value for money. So if we can make things convenient, if we can make them easy to understand, then we've proved that people will adopt sustainable transport as an alternative to their car use.
And it's a really interesting point. Jason, I wonder, are we doing enough as a profession, as providers of infrastructure and providers of transport, to encourage the public to make those sorts of decisions?
Working within the public sector, the easy cop-out on this is that with the right support and the right principles behind society, then it is easier to shift patterns and shift behaviours. Obviously, the challenge is, as engineers working within this sector, there is more that you can do, but obviously it has to be at the pace that ensures that there is community buy-in. So those challenges, absolutely agree with Richard around how we get more people onto public transport, how we can encourage more sustainable travel types, not just within our urban areas, but actually in some of the semi-rural areas, and even then think about accessibility into rural areas as well. All of that is part of what we need to do to shift and decarbonise. Movements in urban areas And removing those doesn't bring down the levels of decarbonisation that we need to see in the same way that some of our probably sort of 10 to 15 to 20 mile into urban journeys or rural journeys actually contribute. So there's a lot that we need to do within the urban areas. Shift within those areas is usually a little bit easier to make because those alternative options are more accessible generally. But actually, there's a huge contribution in terms of transport carbon from some of our longer journeys as well that we really need to tackle. And those processes and plans are partly there. I think the challenge to us is how we progress at the right pace. Absolutely noting that those elements of economic support and economic activity within any region does massively rely upon our current transport network, our current use of cars as well. And obviously within that, yes, brilliant if we can begin to move to EVs. Whether that is the utopia of solutions is maybe a different podcast. But actually the process of people getting to and from jobs, getting to and from school, carrying your kit and your tools in the back of the van, that has to be built into the changes that we make to make sure that we don't stifle what we need to support through the economy and growth as well.
Beyond Brunel, talking about the future of infrastructure in the Southwest. From the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest.
We could easily spend a lot of money on the sort of electric vehicle transition. But the reality is, unless we have significant investment in the national grid, particularly in the Southwest, we won't be able to either generate or transmit that electricity to power these EVs. It's the elephant in the room. It's a bigger problem in some respects than getting an EV into every driveway or onto every city street or even in a rural setting. I mean, in terms of how we develop our road network, sustainable transport modes need an advantage over the car. And I think looking forward, when I look at infrastructure, you know, I want to see bus priority put where it is going to make a meaningful difference, not where it happens to fit. I think that when we're designing, you know, there's lots of policy that isn't directly transport that has an implication to how the road network is utilised. You know, we're designing housing estates on the premise of the fact that there will only be one car per household or no car. And then we don't put the traffic management schemes in there to allow the access and egress of a bus because there's two or three cars per household parked in those estates. So we're not keeping it real. So, you know, why are we designing new towns and new housing estates where the bus has to go in, turn around and come back out? You know, we don't necessarily join up that thinking. So planning needs to take a part in there. Education policy hugely affects how our road network is utilised. So it needs a whole society approach to make sure that we're living our best lives and we're not hampering mobility, because ironically, we all want to improve social mobility. You know, the area where we've got the most growth in patronage on buses is in young people. Less people are taking their driving tests. Owning your first car is hugely expensive. What we've got to do is make sure we don't limit their opportunities through our lens on infrastructure and road use. We've got to be designing a system that works for them, a one-stop shop, so that they can go about their lives without detriment because they can't afford a car. You know, we've got enough poverty as it is, and that bandwidth is growing. And mobility is one of the biggest barriers to education, to work, to wealth. So we need more social mobility without creating more traffic. And that needs a whole system response, in my opinion.
And Jason, that planning piece is clearly very important then. I wonder, is our current policy hampering our efforts to create more sustainable roads?
I don't think it necessarily is in terms of policy terms. There are some good established approaches for any new developments that are required of developments, developers, and to some extent users as they move in. I think as Richard picked up, there's one element setting the policy on how something is designed. There's a second element in terms of ensuring that the design is used in the way that it was initially intended. So that element of properties only having one space for a car, that doesn't stop people buying a property and then owning two or three cars. So I think there is some challenge in terms of how we make the application of that policy or those policies, I guess, easier to cope with, easier to live with through the communities that use those areas. And some of that is around being realistic. We know that car usage and ownership is reducing, that next generation of drivers coming through. If we can begin to put those other alternative forms of transport solution in place and better access by people, then the ability to have a two-car family that becomes a one-car family or three-car becomes two-car actually improves as well. So I think there's probably plenty of policy levers out there. And the trick is how and when you apply those and getting that public support to live within, if you like, the ethos of those policies.
And climate change, it's something which is very present. We're obviously seeing differences in our global temperatures. We've seen fires in Greece and other nations close by of late. I wonder, Richard, in terms of the impacts that climate change is having on our road network and the impacts that your drivers might be seeing, how much of a difference is it having in the way that you run your operations, you know, whether it's through flooding or whatever it might be?
So climate change is a big topic. You know, bringing it back, what does weather do to us in this immediate time? We are seeing more extremes of heavy rain, standing water on roads, blocked drains. You definitely see it in terms of the standing water is probably the biggest and most common thing that we come across. And, you know, a lot of the roads that we operate on have got grass in the middle. You know, we have a deeply rural network as well as an urban network. And drainage isn't part of that. You're seeing runoff from fields that we wouldn't historically have seen. And if you go on YouTube, you can find lots of images of buses with water up to the passengers' ankles as drivers have tried to drive their way through. But these are still the exceptions. The most immediate impact I see is degradation of the road surface. It's just an endless challenge for those people responsible for maintaining the roads and, you know, just getting the gully suckers out there and cleaning the drains. You know, I think these are areas where resources are thin and we'll probably have to do more maintenance along the way. And I think that that's where a large part of the investment needs to go in the short term.
And Jason, we have seen in the news quite a lot about low emission zones. I'm conscious that we've already got some low emission zones, Bristol, Bath. Can you see the rollout of low emission zones across the wider southwest?
Potentially, or whether it is the rollout of the zones or the rollout of a different fleet that is using the network over time is probably a sort of moot point. Can I see a point in the medium and long-term future where the cleanliness, if you like, of our transport network is much better? Then yes, absolutely. Whether that comes through the use of EVs or alternative fuels, whether it comes through things like better use of buses or trains to actually share movements on a smaller number of transport systems, and whether it comes from more people cycling and walking. So they're all real positives. The challenge is the pace of change and how quickly that begins to bring some benefit to communities, bring some benefit in terms of air quality improvements versus the challenges that we've got with climate and global warming. And I think that's always the challenge that we're seeing played out, not just in the transport system, but in the energy provision, in the business sector as well.
So whether it's low emission zones or workplace parking levies or toll roads, the way we're collecting our revenues through taxation, whether it be diminishing tax on fuel or car taxation, if we want a better network as a society, we're going to have to pay for it. And whatever mechanism we do for that is going to be unpopular. But the basic principle that if you use more, you pay more, doesn't to me seem like a bad one. You know, so however road pricing moves forward, however car taxation or vehicle taxation moves forward, the current structure will not sustain us into the future. And at the moment, you know, where low emission zones are being implemented, they are deriving benefit, but they're deriving anxiety as well, because they're an add-on to what is already a broken structure of finance. And so in my view, there needs to be a holistic rethink about how we're going to pay for this going forward. And, you know, that's bigger than my pay grade and it's easy for me to say, but that's the truth of the matter. Somebody's going to have to pay. And ultimately, if we don't pay for it through a low emission zone, then it will come through taxation in a different way. You know, we can't dodge the fact that if we want to live in a modern, healthy, friendly, safe society, you know, and transport fits into that basket, we're going to have to find a way to pay for it, or we have to accept less. And if we're not prepared to pay, then the only other thing that you can lose is convenience. And it's so difficult. You asked the question earlier, how do we sell this future? And it's really difficult, because we can sell a really good looking mobile society that's clean and planet friendly and accessible, but we've got to pay for it.
I'd agree on that. That's a key crux of the challenge, and brings it back to the point that I'd made around nobody will argue against those key principles, but the point at which you implement the decisions and it begins to impact on that flexibility of travel, maybe the cost. And we have got some real challenging areas of society that are sometimes most disadvantaged and are very reliant upon an old, less efficient vehicle to get to employment or education. So it is really difficult, but Richard, absolutely right. That balance between, yes, everybody supports the principle, but actually the challenge of landing and some of those really tough changes is where we are and where we continue to work with partners and people like DfT and central government as well.
And in our roles, in the way that we're living our lives, you know, I'm not evangelizing against the car or car use. You know, what we're trying to be advocates for and profits for is a sustainable system for our society where everybody has access to the things that they need to do to live their lives in a sustainable way. We shouldn't be benchmarking each other's behavior, because what you're doing is you're applying a criticism to the way people have to live their lives. What we've got to do, if we really are genuinely going to shift the dial on sustainable transport for all, then we've got to stop being critical about the reason for travel and start looking about the solutions to travel. That's where we have to go. If we criminalize or we demonize car drivers, we're not going to win this battle. You know, we're not going to get ourselves to a cleaner, greener life. We have to bring everybody along in the party, and everybody's going to have to bear some pain, and everybody's going to expect in return some gain. And, you know, as human beings, we've made an art form out of doing that. We can get there.
That demonstrates the challenges of working within a flexible world, doesn't it? From my rural village, which I love very much, but to drop the daughter off for the school bus, to get in for my 8:15 meeting, to be not sure what time I'm going to leave tonight after work, to pick the son up who's doing martial arts tonight. That's the challenge of society and people's lives. And there's some really good examples there in terms of we're samples of the community, and actually how you then implement a more sustainable regime into something that is inherently flexible, or if it's anything like my home life, chaotic.
So, Richard, I'm very keen to pick up on verges, because I'm conscious that many local councils now are keeping unkept verges, and reasons around biodiversity and pollination and all that sort of stuff. But do you think the public get it?
I think the public in the main think that it's a cost-cutting measure, not an environmental measure. I think that it's appropriate. I think it has its place, you know, as long as it doesn't compromise safety. And I think in our part of the world, an awful lot of the hedges and hedgerows contain dirty great granite boulders that are there lying in wait for the unwary. I mean, we suffer an awful lot of glass damage from tree strikes, where trees are now, you know, below the minimum height requirement on roads. And I don't envy the local authorities and those responsible for roads, because actually keeping on top of it is really, really difficult, because, you know, you have a wet spell and you get a boost of growth, and then all of a sudden, you know, tree management and hedge management, they're really, really under pressure. I mean, we're constantly in dialogue about keeping the highway clear, because we're probably a more habitual user of the road network than many, because what we do is day in, day out. So I like to see green. I like to see hedgerows with natural meadows, but it shouldn't be in the way of safe use of the roads.
And now I'm going to bring us back to our question that we raised at the beginning. So, does the South West need a rethink on roads? And I wonder if both Jason and Richard, you know, has your view changed following our discussion, or are there perhaps different things that you can see going forward based on each other's discussion? So, Richard, I'm going to ask you first. Does the South West need a rethink on roads?
I think this has been a really interesting conversation, and I've listened to Jason really, really closely. And I think having that different perspective on road use and how we develop the network for the future has been really useful for me, because it's very easy to get sort of blinkered in your own space and only see your own challenges. I think the South West, whether it's rethinking or keep thinking, I think the road network is inherently important to the way people lead their lives. And so I think we do need to rethink how we will use it for the future. And I think as we consider the devolution challenge and taking control of our destiny, if that's the way that our political leaders take us, we really need to be thinking about how will we make all the community work, not just some of the communities. And given our rural setting, given our population density, and given our, you know, low GVA, I think we do have to rethink it, because how we help people move around the Southwest is absolutely paramount if we're going to solve health, education, access to work. So very long-winded way of saying yes.
Oh, that's great. And I think, yeah, really reflects some of the really important discussions we've had today. And Jason, I'm going to cast it back to you now. Does the Southwest need a rethink on roads? And has your view changed based on the discussions we've had today?
The discussion's been really useful. I'm not sure it's necessarily changed by my overall thinking on it, because I think some of the points that we've covered and you've asked about, Richard have put forward, continue to be really valid. I really liked Richard's view on actually whether it's a rethink or we continue to think, because I think a lot of the challenges are already known. A lot of the policies are already in place. There are some really difficult decisions around implementation. So I think rather than having a rethink, I think continuing to think, continuing to involve partners to help us navigate through what the best approaches are, but probably more importantly, continuing to communicate with central and local government and with our communities is really key, because they will be the areas where changes need to be supported and landed. And they will be the ones who are best able to make some of the changes that we've maybe covered today as those that are needed.
That's been such an insightful discussion. Thank you hugely to my guests, both in the studio and online today. In the studio, of course, we had Richard Stevens, Managing Director of Go Southwest, and joining us online was Jason Hamm, Director of Transport and Highways at Gloucestershire County Council. Really interesting discussion. You've been listening to the Beyond Brunel podcast, and I hope you can join us again.
You've been listening to Beyond Brunel from the Southwest Infrastructure Partnership, supported by ICE Southwest. Search for us on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter at SWIP Partnership and at ICE Southwest. Beyond Brunel is presented by Christopher Ackland, a Fresh Air Studios production.